It's that time, folks. The time for the 10 Best of the Year lists. We play excerpts from 10 of our favorite episodes in 2021. This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It was so hard to pick the 10 top author interviews of the year. I winnowed the group down from 15 to 10 in chronological order. We start out with our January interview with Hugh Raffles. When Hugh Raffles' two sisters died suddenly within a few weeks of each other, he reached for rocks, stones, and other seemingly solid objects as anchors in a world unmoored, as ways to make sense of these events through stories far larger than his own. The book that emerged is The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. It's a profound and affirming meditation, grounded in stories of stones, Neolithic stone circles, Icelandic lava, petrified whale blubber in Svalbard, the marble prized by Manhattan's Lenape Indians, and a huge Greenlandic meteorite that arrived with six Inuit adventurers in New York City in 1897. Hugh Raffles is the author of the acclaimed book Insectopedia and of In Amazonia, A Natural History. You won much acclaim for your last book, Insectopedia. What moved you to go from insects to rocks?
You know, part of it was that I think I was so caught in this idea of writing a book that was focused on a kind of object or a thing that I immediately, when I was thinking about the next book, I just went from one sort of category of thing to another category of thing. And so went from insects to rocks. And it was rocks because for the insect book, I did some fieldwork in China and on fighting crickets. And it was people who trained crickets to fight. And I love that field work. It was, you know, people were amazing. They had these incredible relationships with these tiny little insects. They really knew how to communicate with them. But while I was doing the field work, I started to meet people who collected these stones called, which, you know, I think here people know as scholars' rocks. Sometimes they're like stones that people keep on their desks, or you'd also see them in parks or gardens or that sort of thing. So very different sizes. And many of the people who I talked to talked about them in these very sort of very sophisticated ways as these like contemplative objects. And that really got me thinking about stones in ways that I hadn't done before and got me interested in really thinking about what it would be like to write a book about them, because there was just so much more complicated, I think. And this wasn't even the geology part of it. These were just sort of as objects which just people develop relationships with and created all kinds of, you know, ways of thinking and emotion. And so I just started to get very interested in that, and the book really, I think, developed from there.
Hugh Raffles is the author of the acclaimed book Insectopedia and of In Amazonia, A Natural History. That was Hugh Raffles telling us about The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. The book was a New York Times editor's choice for 2021. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next, in a year of escalating climate disasters, we spoke in February with famed climate scientist Michael Mann. As the evidence that the climate crisis is upon us now, the voices saying climate change is a hoax are fewer in number, a certain recently passed president notwithstanding. But that doesn't mean the fossil fuel industry or its minions have given up. Instead, they've adopted a soft denialism, one that uses divide and conquer tactics to turn climate activists against each other, deflects attention from the need for systemic change by focusing on individual responsibility, or seeks to discredit climate heroes like Bill McKibben in order to weaken the fight against the carbon pollution that threatens our survival. In his new book, The New Climate War, world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann describes the fossil fuel industry's tactics of divide, deflect, and discredit, and shows what we can do to counter them. And he pushes back against the climate doomers to give us reason to hope that we can win the climate war for a healthy planet. This is just a terrific book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. So you say we're in a war with those you call, and I love this phrase, the climate inactivists. Who are the climate inactivists?
You know, the inactivists, as I call them, are the forces of inaction. They're the institutions, the individuals, the organizations that continue to be behind this effort to prevent us from fundamentally acting on climate, from decarbonizing our civilization, because they profit from our continued addiction to fossil fuels. And so we're talking about the fossil fuel industry, of course, but the various organizations that promote their interests, various industry front groups, dark money organizations, paid talking heads and flacks who advocate for the fossil fuel industry, who in the past were engaged in an effort to discredit the underlying science of climate change. But as I explained in The New Climate War, they have turned to a new array of tactics as denial becomes essentially impossible, because it's too obvious to the person on the street that climate change is here and it's already impacting us. So they've turned to a whole new array of tactics to prevent us from taking action. Of course, the conservative media is a very important part of that effort as well, working in essence for fossil fuel interests to fill our public discourse with misinformation and disinformation, and to confuse the discussion, to distract us, to deflect attention, to divide us, and all of these other things that they're doing to block action.
Michael Mann talking about the new climate war. The book won numerous accolades, including being listed by several major publications among the best books of 2021. And also in February, we spoke with Heather McGee about her groundbreaking book, The Sum of Us. President Lyndon Johnson famously said once, if you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you. Since the civil rights movement of the 1960s, a majority of white voters have chosen Republican candidates over Democrats. And since that time, middle and working class white folks have seen their incomes flat or declining, the decimation of the unions that had once protected their incomes, and the constant narrowing of access to public goods like education and health care. Is there a connection? You bet, says my guest, Heather McGee. Her new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, shows how the racist zero-sum narrative has led to the impoverishment of middle and working class Americans of all races and ethnicities. And overturning that narrative will mean a new race-class narrative that builds solidarity for all. You start out this powerful and comprehensive book by saying, why can't we have nice things? What are the nice things you're talking about, and who is the we?
Well, the nice things are not flying cars like we're supposed to have, or laundry that does itself, which would be nice to have. But I really mean the nice things that a society of our wealth and development should have, like universal health care and modern world-class infrastructure and robust public health system to handle pandemics. And the we who doesn't have that those things is all Americans, both the white Americans, who are the largest group of the uninsured and the impoverished, and the people of color, who are disproportionately so.
Yeah, I think that so often, you know, gets elided. We talk about peoples of color and it's true, who are the first and worst to lose access or to not have access to begin with, but that just by virtue of demographic numbers, there are more in numbers of white people who are poor. And I think that that is really, you know, the center of the book is how racism has gotten in the way of all of us having nice things. Talk about, how does racism actually accelerate inequality for everybody?
You know, this was a new thought to me. I spent nearly 20 years working in economic and public policy, trying to research and advocate for solutions to economic inequality broadly, tax policy, labor policy, financial regulation, these kinds of topics. And I always thought about race. I'm a Black woman, so, you know, the impact on people of color, and Black people particularly, was very important to me. But I thought of it in the way that kind of the economic orthodoxy tells us to think about it, which is there are these economic issues over here, and then there's the way that discrimination and disadvantage sort of compound on top of those economic decisions to make outcomes worse for people of color. And when I left running a think tank, which I was doing for a number of years, to go on a journey across the country for almost 4 years to write the book, The Sum of Us, I was going in pursuit of the answer to that question about nice things, and also on a hunch about the way that racism actually is at its core exemplified by this zero-sum worldview that is very predominant among white Americans, less so among people of color. The idea that progress for people of color has to come at white people's expense. You know, every dollar in my pocket means a dollar less in yours. And at its core, that zero-sum racial hierarchy is what has left us as a country poorer, has left the white majority to sort of cheer economic policies that are kind of stingier and meaner and more cruel than would be in their self-interest, because there's a sense that it might be in the interest of people of color.
Heather McGee talking about The Sum of Us. It was long listed for the National Book Award. Watch the trailer for the book at writersvoice.net. March saw our interview with New Yorker environmental writer Elizabeth Colbert talking about her book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Have you heard the trope that technology will save us from climate catastrophe? Well, that may have to be true, because our inaction now calls for drastic measures. But will the cure be as bad or worse than the disease? Will solar engineering, for example, blot out so much of the sun's light that crops will fail all over the globe? So pervasive are human impacts on the planet that it's said we live in a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene. In her latest book, Under a White Sky, Elizabeth Colbert takes a hard look at the new world we're creating. She examines how the very sorts of interventions that have imperiled our planet are increasingly seen as the only hope for its salvation. By turns inspiring, terrifying, and darkly comic, Under a White Sky is an utterly original examination of the challenges we face. Here she talks about genetic engineering of endangered species and abrupt climate reversals in the geological record.
You know, the book basically follows all these examples of situations that people have created by interfering in one way or another with natural processes, either the flooding of the Mississippi or the flow of the Chicago River, or in the case of some of the chapters that involve biology, by moving species around the world, or by, you know, wrecking a species habitat, or by, in one case, warming up the entire ocean. And in every case, now we're faced with this question, okay, well, these changes that we've brought about, in a lot of other species are suffering as a result of that. So now there's sort of, you know, this sort of new wave of conservation projects that aim to actually manipulate the species themselves. So it's conceivable nowadays, because of the extraordinary advances that have been made in gene editing, to identify traits that would allow species to withstand various threats and to try to gene edit them so that, you know, they possess the right genetic tweak. And that's, I think, going to become a bigger and bigger question in conservation is, you know, to what extent, if you're trying to save a species, but you have to change it to save it, you know, to what extent are you saving that species? And we're going to have to answer that question because, you know, there are so many threats to so many species, and because gene editing is such a potentially powerful tool.
So now let's talk about some of the other conundrums. And you're not really saying we shouldn't do the, it's more like, here we are, right? This is what we're faced with. We either...
Exactly. Here we are. That's a pretty good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, we either destroy everything or just maybe something. And we may end up destroying everything anyway, but we might just save ourselves. So let's turn to climate impacts. First of all, I'd like to ask you about something that I never knew before, and that is, you say that ice cores that go hundreds of thousands of years into the past, that is, they are taken, their samples taken from deep enough in the Arctic ice to show the climate back that far. You say they show that the climate has actually been incredibly unstable, with, you know, huge swings, even larger swings than we anticipate seeing here, sometimes in the case of decades, not millennia. What does this mean for us?
Well, that's a very interesting question that no one can answer at this point. You know, ice cores from Greenland are an extraordinarily powerful tool for looking at the climate of the past, and what they contain, if you know how to read them, as it were, is an archive of temperatures going back to basically the beginning of the last ice age, so about 110, 115,000 years ago. And what these ice cores show, and they've shown time and time again, and now is just accepted as a fact, is that during the last ice age, which only ended about 12,000 years ago, there were these huge temperature swings that occurred in a matter of decades. So temperatures would, you know, warm up to almost non-ice age conditions, and then they'd plunge again. And whether this is a function of how you could get such powerful swings so quickly is really still an open question. No one is entirely sure of that. And whether they could potentially, such a swing could potentially be triggered, you know, by our own messing around with the climate is unclear, because now we are no longer in an ice age. We're in what should be an interglacial period, a period between ice ages, although we have succeeded in putting off the next ice age for all intents and purposes forever through our carbon emissions. But no one is entirely sure what the mechanism was. And so no one is entirely sure whether we are risking another such climate swing.
Elizabeth Colbert, read an excerpt from Under a White Sky at writersvoice.net. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're playing clips from some of our favorite interviews in 2021. In May, we spoke with NPR reporter Michaeline Duclef about her parenting self-help book, Hunt, Gather, Parent. I have to confess, when I first heard about Michaeline Duclef's book, Hunt, Gather, Parent, I thought to myself, just another parenting book. When my son was growing up, I consulted a lot of them, but only one or two told me anything useful. So I was intrigued but skeptical when I sat down to read about what Duclef had to say about what ancient cultures can teach us about the lost art of raising happy, helpful little humans, the subtitle of her book. I was quickly won over by Duclef's combination of her personal story, trying to parent her strong-willed young daughter, her research into parenting styles of three indigenous cultures, including Maya families in Mexico, Inuit families above the Arctic Circle, and Hadzabe families in Tanzania, and her eminently practical suggestions. But her ideas don't just work for young children. They work for relationships we have with family members of all ages. You start this book out with the daily power struggles with your then toddler, Rosie, so very, very young child, and you were afraid that you and her were becoming enemies. Tell us what was happening.
You know, Rosie has just, from the time she was born, she was very fiery, you know, like as a baby, there was a lot of crying and I had really no clue how to stop her sometimes. But then as she became a toddler, it became much more physical. You know, she would start to have a tantrum and I really wanted to help her, but everything I kind of did seemed to make things worse. And we would kind of get into this cycle of like, I would make her more angry. And then eventually I would get angry at her. And of course, me getting upset and angry at a yelling toddler only made things much worse. And so then I would try to pick her up and console her. And then she was in this habit of like slapping me across the face. And it was literally happening, I don't know, several times a week, you know, sometimes like in the supermarket. And I was kind of like, this is only going to get worse, right? Like as she gets older, we are just going to be stuck in this kind of, I need her to do something and she doesn't want to do it. And then there's an emotional outburst and then I get upset. And it just seemed like we were really going to be stuck. And to be honest with you, I had kind of given up. I was kind of like, well, this is just how it's going to be. You know, she's a strong-willed child. And I didn't think that there was going to be much to do about it.
Right. And you found actually that there is a different way that people raise children. And those are ways that, in fact, people have practiced, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, most likely, but now are mostly practicing in more indigenous communities. How did you first understand, get an inkling that the way we do it in our Western nations is not the way maybe most humans have been doing it for most of our history?
Yeah. So about the same time as Rosie was a toddler and this was happening, like completely independently, I was sent on an assignment. I'm a correspondent, a global health correspondent at NPR. And I was sent on an assignment down to the Yucatan Peninsula to a small Maya village. And I was actually doing a story about children's attention span. There is some research that showed that in certain situations, Maya children were better at paying attention than, you know, middle-class American kids. And so I was really curious about this, like, what, you know, why is this? And I went down there and I spent a fair amount of time in families' homes talking to moms, mostly moms, because those are the ones that were in the homes. And what I saw had nothing to do with attention, or I was just like blown away by actually the way the moms related to the children. First of all, I spoke into my microphone at the time, just taking notes. And I was just like, there's such little resistance. Like there's such little conflict. The moms are calm yet very confident and clearly in charge, but there's no yelling or bickering or negotiating with the kids. And the kids at the same time were really great. They, you know, they were respectful and generous with each other and with their friends and super, super helpful. So one morning, a 12-year-old girl, I was talking to a mom, Maria Tumborges. She has three daughters, and the oldest one, they were on spring break, and the oldest one was sleeping in because she had stayed up late to watch a shark movie. And she woke up around 10 or 11, and she walks past me and her mom and just starts doing the dishes, like without anyone asking her. And that was like just the first thing she did in the morning on her spring break. And I was very surprised. And Maria wasn't at all. She was like, you know, she's 12. She knows what needs to be done and should be done. And so she does it now. She's old enough to know. And she also said, you know, it doesn't happen every day. And I left there just really like struck by this, first by this, the very calm, cooperative relationship that I saw between the parents and the children, but also in this way of like, this 12-year-old child who genuinely wanted to help her family. And really, I asked her, I was like, why are you doing the dishes? And she said, I like helping my mom. So it kind of seeded this doubt in my mind of like, oh, like here I am with a kid that I can't even get, you know, to not hit me. And here's this mom with three daughters. And she had a 4-year-old at the time and, you know, was just seemed incredibly skilled at interacting with her children in a way that was very productive. And so I started to wonder, like, maybe what I've been taught as a mom isn't the best way. And I actually went on another reporting trip up to the Arctic to an Inuit town. And by golly, I started to see similar things. I started to see this, a very similar way of interacting with children. And so I started doing research on it and realized that this actually is a very common way of interacting and relating to children. That's likely, like you say, tens of thousands of years old, given like how common it is around the world. And even elements of it, you know, you can still find today in parts of Europe, and you can find it in communities here in the U.S. as well.
Michaeline Duclef. Watch a video about hunt-gather parent at writersvoice.net. In June, Scottish writer Cal Flynn told us about her book, Islands of Abandonment. After the nuclear disaster in Chernobyl, only a handful of people went back to their dangerously irradiated homes. But animals that haven't been seen there in centuries have returned. Wolves, bears, and other denizens of wild places. The devastated Bikini Atoll, site of the last atomic bomb test, the biggest nuclear explosion ever set off, is now teeming with underwater biodiversity. These and other so-called wastelands are the subject of Cal Flynn's extraordinary book, Islands of Abandonment. Flynn says we need to see these areas not as ruined places, but as testaments to the incredible resilience of life. Exploring extraordinary places where humans either no longer live or survive in just tiny, precarious numbers, Islands of Abandonment gives us a glimpse of what nature gets up to when we're not there to see it. From Tanzanian mountains to the volcanic Caribbean, the forbidden areas of France to the mining regions of Scotland, Flynn brings together some of the most desolate, eerie, ravaged, and polluted areas in the world. And she shows how, against all odds, they may just offer our best opportunities for environmental recovery. This book, Islands of Abandonment, really is a hopeful book in places that speak of terrible destruction and loss. The subtitle is Nature Rebounding in the Post-Human Landscape. First, just tell us, what brought you to this topic, to this idea?
I suppose I've been interested in questions of nature and the environment and ethical questions around conservation for a while. But a lot of nature writing really focuses on this idea of sort of wilderness or the pristine. And actually, I'm really aware that most landscapes that we exist in today are not sort of untouched wildernesses, but are in fact sort of quite deeply impacted by humans. So I suppose I've been interested in that sort of friction. I became really interested in what I came to think of as man-made landscapes or sort of post-industrial landscapes or damaged landscapes after I traveled to this amazing place just off the west coast of Scotland. They're called the Slate Islands, and they were the epicenter for slate quarrying during the 19th century. They were called the islands that roofed the world. But if you go now, they're very quiet. There are a few holiday cottages. Then there are these just enormous quarries that have been flooded by seawater. The islands have really been sort of hollowed out by industry, but they've become very beautiful, and they're full of this sort of strange turquoise brackish water that you can swim in. They're full of brambles and wildflowers. And I found that this weird sort of mongrel, even feral landscape was very beautiful, but in an unusual way. And I guess that sort of sent me off down this path that I so enjoyed spending time there and really felt sort of the edge of the wild being there, because there were all these plants growing and sort of animals living in strange bits of undergrowth and all sorts. And you really felt that things were recovering. And I suppose that's become the overarching theme of my book, Islands of Abandonment. It's stories of redemption or finding hope in hopeless places. And I think that's something that we can all, especially us who are concerned by questions of climate and the environment, I think we can all hope to find some more hope in our lives.
Cal Flynn's book, Islands of Abandonment, was shortlisted for the British Academy Book Prize, among other honors. More of our 10 best author interviews of 2021 after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're looking back at some of our favorite author interviews of 2021. In July, we caught up with Nina Burley to talk about the systemic failures behind the U.S.'s botched response to the COVID pandemic. Her book is Virus. As the U.S. begins to see yet another surge in COVID-19 cases, driven by the Delta variant and vaccine resistance promoted by GOP lies, it's useful to consider how exactly we got here. Nina Burley's book, Virus, is a penetrating analysis of just that. She reveals how the confluence of key government missteps, behind-the-scenes corruption, staggering dismissal of decades of scientific progress, conspiracy theories, and other malfeasance were behind the hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths. Among the issues Virus covers are how the Trump administration packed public health agencies with right-wing Christians and their political allies who cared more about policing morality than a possible pandemic. How the anti-government ideologues of the Trump administration were so enamored of extreme free market principles that they treated the pandemic as a business opportunity. How anti-science ideologues of the right-wing media and conservative politicians have left countless millions of Americans doubting the efficacy and safety of vaccines, and much more. It's a terrific book, trenchant, absorbing, and necessary. You write in the preface to the book that you questioned yourself and your assumptions. What were the biggest assumptions that you questioned?
Well, I mean, the first assumption was that if something like this were to happen, the U.S. government would marshal all of the powers at its disposal to assist the population. And in fact, that was not what we saw happening from the very beginning. We saw the opposite, a retraction and an abdication to private industry or to people's good luck and access to money and the ability to hide. And that really is not much different from what was happening in the 16th or 17th century book that I took down off my shelf that I also mentioned in the lead, in the prologue to the book, Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year. Many, many, many similarities. We have antibiotics, we have vaccines now, but we just have not advanced too far socially from the late 17th century.
Yes, and while you do fault, of course, the Trump administration, because they were the ones in power at the time, the problems go deeper and further back than that. But let's start with Smash the State, which is the first chapter. I love that title there. You open with a quote from Steve Bannon, which was the one about putting Dr. Anthony Fauci's head on a spike. Why did you start there?
Well, I started there because I've covered American politics off and on for decades, and I have watched sort of the powers behind the political theater that we all see, know, and love. I've watched those powers develop, and I've come to understand them more over the years, and covered the Trump administration, the election, and the administration for 4 years. And I thought that the best place to start explaining what was happening was to explain the poles of the two ideologies that undergirded the former administration. One of them being the smash the state. The Bannon quote, I think, goes on to say, let's get back to Tudor England or something. Let's get back to feudalism. The appropriate way to sort of organize ourselves socially is to have government shrunk down to the size of a pinhead, which is what Robert Mercer, the great strange financier behind the whole operation, supposedly liked to say. Smash the state goes all the way back, though, really to the Reagan years. That was the very beginning of this long game of vilifying the idea that the government can do good and deliver good to people, and instead uplifting the notion of absolute deregulation, unfettered vulture capitalism, no tax or low tax. And the Trump administration was kind of the zenith of that, where they went in with the Heritage Foundation people and just went after the agencies and started dismantling them to the point where, you know, you had the Energy Department, you know, the physicists were kicked out, and Eric Trump's buddy was, you know, had his feet up on a desk in there. So that's why I started there, because, of course, the government was where most people would look when a national crisis like this erupts. And this administration really used this opportunity to road test at its most extreme the notion that private enterprise would do a better job at anything that the government might attempt to do.
Nina Burley talking about virus, vaccinations, the CDC, and the hijacking of America's response to the pandemic. Hear the entire interview at writersvoice.net. The coronavirus and the climate crises were, of course, two of the three big issues dominating the news cycle in 2021. The third was police violence after the murder of George Floyd unleashed nationwide protests. In August, we spoke about the history of racist police violence with Elizabeth Hinton. Her book is America on Fire. The Black Lives Matter movement that erupted in 2014, when first Eric Garner and then Michael Brown were murdered by police, is not the first time Black communities in America went out in the streets to protest police violence. In her brilliant book, America on Fire, historian Elizabeth Hinton takes the reader on a journey from Detroit in 1967 and Miami in 1980 to Los Angeles in 1992 and beyond to chart the persistence of structural racism and one of its primary consequences, what the white power structure calls riots, but what Black people call rebellions. The central lesson from these eruptions, that police violence invariably leads to community violence, continues to escape policymakers, who respond by further criminalizing entire groups instead of addressing the underlying causes. The results are the hugely expanded policing and prison regimes that shape the lives of so many Americans today. America on Fire is a powerful call to end structural racism and finally realize the American promise of full equality for all. This terrific book, America on Fire, is really about the rebellions, Black rebellions of the 1960s and early 70s, and the white power structure's violence and how they interrelate with each other. You call the 60s and the early 70s a crucible of rebellion. In fact, you have 26 closely printed pages in small type of Black rebellions from 1964 to 1972, just 8 years. I didn't realize there had been so many. But my first question is, there have been Black rebellions since the days of slavery, and white violence has been a constant since the beginning of slavery. Why did you focus on this time period?
So the 1960s is this moment when, you know, of course, in the context of massive demographic transformations and the height of progressive social change and the civil rights movement, when new forms of collective protest, collective mass violence begin to emerge in segregated low-income communities across the United States. That's in response to the continued lack of socioeconomic transformations and changes in low-income communities of color, coupled with the escalation of police force. And so this period in particular, I think, is really important to understanding the continued tensions between communities and police today, but also larger questions about how resources are allocated by our elected officials, systemic racism, and how we might finally realize the founding principle of equality. I mean, of course, this is tied to a much longer history that's rooted in slavery, but this period of the 1960s, I think, is key to understanding where we are today. And in many ways, we're living in the aftershocks of the extreme violence of that period.
Now, before we go further, let's talk about this term rebellion, because the urban conflagrations of the 1960s are typically referred to as riots. That means typically by mainstream society. You say that is the wrong word. Rebellions is the correct word. Tell us why.
Well, from the outset, in labeling, you know, when President Lyndon Johnson, in response to the unrest in Harlem in 1964, after a 15-year-old high school student was killed by a New York City police officer, immediately, you know, failed to recognize the real connections between the grievances of those who participated in several days of violence in New York City and other cities that summer, like Philadelphia and Chicago and Rochester, New York, where the National Guard had to be called, the connections between this form of political violence and civil rights protests that were rooted in the same set of grievances. That is, you know, fundamentally a demand for greater political and economic inclusion in American society, protection against white supremacist terrorist violence, an end to police brutality, and then, of course, jobs, educational opportunities, decent housing. These were the same set of grievances that led people to loot stores and burn buildings and throw rocks at police officers in Harlem and other cities that summer. And yet Johnson said, this has nothing to do with civil rights. You know, this is criminal. It's senseless. It's lawless. And in labeling this political act, again, rooted in civil rights grievances, as lawless, then the only response becomes more police, which is, of course, you know, literally the force, the precipitating factor that leads to the violent encounters in the first place. So we've been stuck in this policy cycle, in a sense, ever since, that the response to these grievances that lead people to think they have no recourse but to embrace these violent tactics is the very thing that that causes them to rebel in the first place. And, you know, this is in some ways the lessons of this period and where terminology really matters, because again, if this political action is seen as criminal, then the only response or solution is more police.
Elizabeth Hinton. America on Fire was listed as a New York Times notable book and one of the best books of 2021 by Time and Smithsonian. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're playing clips from some of our favorite interviews in 2021. We spoke with Honoré Fanon Jeffers about her novel The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois in August. Honoré Fanon Jeffers' debut novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, is already racking up the kudos, and it's only been out since August 24th. Oprah picked it for her book club. The New York Times reviewer called it, quote, quite simply the best book that she had read in a very, very long time, and it's up for numerous awards. I'm in the fan club. I read every word of this nearly 800-word masterpiece, including the prologue and acknowledgments, in 2 day-long sittings, and I was utterly rapt. So what's it about? I'll let the great writer Jacqueline Woodson, a former Writer's Voice guest, describe it. She writes, "This sweeping, brilliant, and beautiful narrative is at once a love song to Black girlhood, family, history, joy, pain, and so much more. In Jeffers' deft hands, the story of race and love in America becomes the great American novel. The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois is about a family through the centuries, and also about one young descendant living in the contemporary world who discovers her family's story. This is the Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, and throughout the novel, you have wonderful quotes from Du Bois's work. Why Du Bois? How is he in some way the lodestone of this novel, The Love Songs of W.B. Du Bois?
Well, I was introduced to Du Bois's work when I was in junior high school. And when I went to college, I went to college early and then finished late. So took me 6 years to get through college. But when I went to college, I was 16. And I went to first one historically Black college, Clark College in Atlanta, Georgia, which is now Clark Atlanta University. And we read Du Bois in literature classes. We read Du Bois in history classes. We read Du Bois in political science classes. And then when I transferred to another historically Black college, I noticed the same. He was the center of Black intellectual life. And anybody Black who was considered educated had to have read at least one or two of Du Bois's work. He first went down south to Fisk University in 1885, and he graduated in 1888. And when he was at Fisk University, which is also a historically Black institution, he fell in love with Southern Black people. And this fascination with Black folks, the devotion and the duty to us, was a lifelong charge. And in the same way, the protagonist of the novel, Ailie Pearl Garfield, has this same lifelong charge. She's introduced to Du Bois as a teenager, as I was. But the first time she's introduced is by hearing a relative of hers, Uncle Root, tell her about meeting who he called the great scholar. And then that same summer, Uncle Root gives her an edition of The Souls of Black Folk. And so Du Bois becomes a shadow character all through the book. And his writing guides us through the story of Ailie's family. But what also guides us, and the reason that the title of the novel is what it is, he loved Black people. He loved Southern Black people, like Ailie's family. And so these songs are his songs.
Honoré Fanon Jeffers, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois was longlisted for the National Book Award. Finally, we hear a clip from our November interview with Ale Press about his book, Dirty Work. The last time we spoke with Ale Press, it was about his book, Beautiful Souls. That was about people who take great risks to oppose unjust orders. Now, he's back with a book about those who do the dirty work that society considers essential but morally compromised. In Dirty Work, he examines the drone pilots who carry out targeted assassinations, the undocumented immigrants who man the kill floors of industrial slaughterhouses, the guards who patrol the wards of America's most violent and abusive prisons, and more. But who benefits from this dirty work, and why is it mostly invisible? Press lifts the veil that keeps us shielded from an array of morally questionable activities that other, less privileged people perform in our name. We last spoke with you about Beautiful Souls, your last book, which was about people who put a higher good above their own personal safety, rescuers, for example, in World War II and others. This is almost like the opposite. I mean, it's more than that. But talk a little bit about why you turned your attention to the dirty workers of society, the people who do the dirty work for society.
Well, you're absolutely right. There is a kind of united theme. In Beautiful Souls, my last book, I wrote about people who arrive at these really difficult moments where their principles and values are at stake, and they keep their hands clean. They do the right thing at great risk and often personal cost. And as I was writing that book, I kept meeting people in the different contexts I was writing about who didn't manage to do that, who actually went along with, you know, unjust orders, or who were in situations where they did dirty their hands in some ways. And I got interested in their stories because I think that that's probably most of us. You know, moral courage is rare. It's hard to stand by one's principles when you're under constraints and pressures. And I started thinking a lot more about those constraints and pressures. And Dirty Work isn't just a book about people who do compromising things and go along and dirty their hands. It's also about the social conditions that create those situations. So it's really not just about individuals. It's about our collective values and our collective decisions.
And you define dirty work in two ways. On the one hand, essential workers, some of whom you talk about in the book, but also those who do jobs that many people see as morally compromised. Let's start with the second, since I think that's really the most central to the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right that, you know, when most people hear the phrase dirty work, I think they probably think of like a physically dirtying job, like hauling the garbage off the street. But I'm using it much more to talk about activities that are seen as morally fraught, morally compromised, but crucially, that society depends on in some way or tacitly condones. You know, when we think about, and this is an example in the book, of course, the dirty work of running and operating America's jails and prisons, where violence and abuse is unfortunately rife and is, by the way, the world's largest prison system. Well, there are people working in that system. There are people whose daily jobs involve helping operate that system. Or the dirty work of working on the kill floors of America's industrial slaughterhouses, which, of course, play a crucial role in the American lifestyle and in the American diet. And so in all of these cases, on the one hand, you have work that sort of makes people morally uncomfortable in some way. And then on the other hand, is very much related to big decisions we've made in our society. Political decisions in the case of the prison system, consumer decisions and lifestyle decisions in the case of, you know, eating so much meat.
You also define it as work that causes substantial harm either to people or to non-human animals and the environment. This was a tension that I felt in the book. I mean, of course, we are all complicit, yet some are more complicit than others. There are those who make the rules and who make it very difficult for others to step outside of those rules. I mean, I think we've seen pretty well that most people don't have the power. So I wonder if you could talk about the different levels of complicity.
Sure. Yeah. And I should say, the book very much does make the case that when we think about this dirty work, I think too often our impulse is to pin the blame on the frontline workers doing it, the low-level guards in prisons, the line workers in an industrial slaughterhouse. But my contention is that these workers are agents of society, that the conditions they work under and what they do and how they do it is shaped by much larger forces. Now, you're very right to say, well, wait a minute. Are we all really responsible for those things, or are some more responsible than others? And there's no question that there are gradations. I mean, the book opens with a very graphic story of abuses that take place in a prison in Florida. And as I note in the story and in one of the chapters, there weren't just people tolerating this in Florida. There were actually companies profiting from it because this was a mental health ward of a prison where severe abuses were taking place. And yet that mental health ward was run by two private companies, actually, Wexford and Corizon. And they were making money off of this. So of course we would say, well, they bear more responsibility than a person on the street who opens the newspaper and reads one day that terrible things were going on there, as indeed happened eventually when some of the abuses were reported on by the Miami Herald, including starving prisoners and locking them in a scalding shower. The average person who reads that, you know, they're not as complicit as the private company making the money. And they may genuinely be horrified by this. And at that point say, well, I don't want this done in my name. I don't approve of this. But here's where it gets more complicated. What about the before? What about right now when we're not actually seeing a scandal make the news, but we do know that jails and prisons have become the largest mental health institutions in our society, you know, larger than hospitals, larger than community centers. And that development happened over decades, over years. And it was, I believe, shaped, if not by conscious choices that citizens made, certainly by a large degree of apathy and turning away, that eventually there became a kind of a sense of moral exhaustion. You know, we deinstitutionalized, we closed down these abusive asylums that weren't treating people well, but then a lot of people kind of forgot about it. And what ended up happening is jails and prisons stepped in essentially to do the dirty work of warehousing the mentally ill, particularly in poor communities. And too many, I think, have kind of kept it out of sight, out of mind. And that very much is the nature of dirty work as I describe it. It is in the shadows. It is not front and center in our consciousness. And to that extent, it does implicate more than just, say, the lone profiteering private company that's involved. It involves all of us.
AL Press. Dirty Work was named one of the 10 best books of 2021 by the Chicago Tribune and Publishers Weekly, and one of the 100 notable books of 2021 by the New York Times. That's all we have time for in this end-of-the-year edition of Writer's Voice. There are other interviews that could have been added to the list had we the time. I just want to mention two. Ruth Ozeki telling us about her novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness, and also Julia Zweig, who told us about her biography of Lady Bird Johnson. Go to writersvoice.net for links to those and to the full versions of the interviews on our list of the 10 best of 2021. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.